President Putin has pretty effectively called the bluff of the Western allies and NATO over its invasion of parts of Ukraine. Is that country really on its own now dealing with the Russian challenge? We look beyond the personal invective that surrounded the departure of Sarah Smith for North America as the BBC's correspondent there to ask whether the corporation is making life pretty difficult for its BBC Scotland editor through the general indie negativity of its coverage across the network. We talk also about storms, about information, about how to drive in snow, and the end of COVID protections in England.
Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Choms, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. And I was slightly concerned, Leslie, when you tweeted in the early hours of this morning that you'd looked out the windy and seen lights dancing in the sky. And if I weren't someone who knew that you haven't had a drink in well over a day, I would have been questioning how well your birthday celebrations had actually gone.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it was, I mean, really, thanks everybody for all the messages and everything yesterday. It was really, it's really humbling and sort of lovely when you just get this thunder of stuff. I mean, obviously social media makes it easier because it reminds everybody, you know, but I also got lots of messages from people in the Nordic countries that I'd only met once or twice. You know, a guy in Norway who enjoys setting up Highland Games that I met just on in the passing about 6 years ago, who's definitely trying to get a Norwegian Highland Games going this summer,
you know? Right.
And it's kind of, it's just, it's so touching to have all of that. But yes, I mean, I woke up seized with the next book that I'm going to write, the name of it, everything, at about 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, that kind of time. Went and had a look outside in the skies and saw this. I mean, what you could only call, it looked like a train basically of white lights just going straight across the sky. And I mean, I know it just wasn't going to be natural. It was too straight, you know, it was just weird. I'd never seen anything like it. And thanks to the Simon Brooke, who absolutely kind of came back on it, he sent a piece from The Guardian that suggests that what it is, it's Elon Musk's little clusters of satellites that are being sent up, which is extraordinary. I somehow imagine a cluster just being that, not a sort of, it's almost like literally somebody in the sky is pulling fairy lights literally across the sky. It's the weirdest thing, but it's his satellite galaxies, apparently, and mega constellations, and you know, thousands of them are going up every month. So who knew?
Well we do know. And just as, I mean, just as a horrible thought that given the circumstances we're in, that seeing something over Northeast Fife in terms of lights in the sky, given the current situation between Russia and Ukraine, you know, there's slightly more frightening aspects to it that would have crossed my mind, to be perfectly frank, as someone who unfortunately remembers the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 and genuine impact it had on me. I mean, I remember very, very clearly that October day at 12:15 our time, when I was still in primary school, and went out in the playground for dinner time, and there was the thought that, you know, this could be it. And it the Russians have moved into these two self-declared autonomous people's republics.
I mean, it is really serious stuff for these guys. And I mean, on the one hand, the Ukrainians, and as we've discussed before, everybody who was a previous part actually of the Soviet Empire has been just conscious of, you know, I mean, I hate to use this phrase in some respects, but the Lebensraum ideas of President Putin. And for folk who you don't recognize that one, it's the German word that describes what was actually the larger Germany ideas that Hitler had way back when, the expansionism, the kind of not recognizing independent states, the belief that, you know, well, I mean, in this case, of course, many of these places were, you know, they were part of the Soviet Union, but they have been independent since 1991, most of them. So And they have been in preceding years, they have had their own autonomy. So it's a kind of nonsense argument. And the scariest thing, in a sense, is listening, although obviously none of us can listen to Putin and understand him directly because he was speaking in Russian. But by all accounts, he had about 2 hours of rambling sort of justification. And then this weird kind of almost kind of court, almost like a kind of tribunal rubber stamping when he was asking his officials whether they felt they should go into this so-called peacekeeping mode to help these Russians in the independent areas, the autonomous areas within Ukraine. And, you know, they all sort of sagely come up and say, yes, you know, we feel that this is justified. It's kind of quango courts. It's kangaroo courts, rather. It's kind of just terrifying to see what those of us who are old enough to have these frameworks in our mind. We didn't experience the Second World War, but, you know, we're old enough to have it sitting there as kind of the methods that were used to justify actions that had no justification. And it's all happening. And by gum, has it ever just exposed the complete weakness of the West? Jeez.
Yes.
I mean, you know, everybody's rumbling away about sanctions being ready, and they're not ready. You know, they're not. It's not agreed. Germany and Italy don't want energy included in any sanctions. France wants sanctions to be targeted. They're arguing about whether invading these sort of autonomous areas that were already run by Russian-backed people, whether that really amounts to a full-scale invasion. You know, as in, do the Russians need to hit Kiev before there's action taken for full fat sanctions? And, you know, there's also huge antagonism towards President Macron, who, if anyone doesn't remember, was just a few days ago saying that he had so kind of, you know, sweet talked President Putin during these long kind of phone calls at the weekend on the phone that they were about to set up a Biden Putin summit. That was how well the whole thing was going. And I mean, just quite clearly, as mentioned the last time, you know, Putin has always had his own idea of what he's doing. He's played everybody. You know, everybody's been flying around the place as if anything they said would actually make the blindest bit of difference. And all the time, you know, these false flag attacks were being planned as a justification to park themselves in parts of Ukraine, as the Russians have done in little pockets of other countries all around their border. It's just a terrible position for all those countries to be in. And there's old Estonia, you know, we're just moving closer to it. It's their Independence Day anniversary on Thursday, like, you know, this week. This is the day they all pitch up at 6:30 in the morning to watch the flag being hoisted, as we filmed in the film we made 2 years ago. These guys are going to be, I mean, absolutely on tenterhooks. And at the same time, they've been kind of, it just gives us an idea of what their real is, because actually, you know, Russia's been sitting across a river there for, you know, it doesn't go away. It's been there for 30 years. So it's a pretty dreadful situation. And this thing about sanctions is also interesting, because there was a good piece actually on Good Morning Scotland at the weekend, which is generally a very good foreign coverage day, Saturday. And they had a chap on who was a real expert in this, who was looking at what the Tories had come up with by way of, you know, trying to stop the money that's been pouring into the city of London from Russian oligarchs and the like. And they've basically abolished the golden visas. These were a way to skip the queue for residency if you invested 2 million quid in Britain. But as the guy pointed out, when all this dodgy stuff started was probably 7 years ago or more. By that time, anybody who got residency had the right to indefinitely remain 5 years later. After that, they just had to wait another 1 year for citizenship. So actually, everybody who did the dodgy golden visa stuff 7 years ago and more, and I remember this happening when I worked in London, and that's 25 years ago, those guys are all British citizens now. So it's too late. And the other thing he was saying was that lots of the sanctions stuff that's being proposed by Britain sounds pretty good, because they're broad sanctions, which is apparently what's needed against this kind of kleptocrats. But the trouble in Britain is they're not enforceable. The National Crime Office, the Serious Fraud Office, they're all underfunded. They're very weak. So there's all this stuff here that's kind of looks pretty impressive, but nobody goes in and actually makes sure that, you know, these sorts of systems aren't being used. And apparently the reason that there was a lot of reluctance to even close down more loopholes was not really because of Russia, particularly Russian money. There was an observation that Russia's economy is about the size of Spain, but it's very unequal. So the top 500 people own the same wealth as 99% of the rest of the population. If that reminds you somewhere. And what they're saying is that it's not them that's worrying everybody so much. It's that if Britain cracks down on the loopholes, the actual Scottish limited partnerships that Roger Mullen MP highlighted, if all of that gets cracked down on, it's the other countries with corrupt officials, Nigeria and above all China. It's China. Chinese were the big golden visa users. It wasn't Russia. So, you know, it's kind of just shining a light as every time there's a stress on our democracy, whether it's COVID, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Brexit, it just shines a light onto the underlying, well, corruption and elitism that has created a lack of ability to respond well and to make any of the sanctions that people are rumbling around really stick. So it's a sore effect for sure.
Yeah, because I mean, Sajid Javid was on the Today programme and he was saying that they're now triggered. The sanctions are now triggered. But again, very little pressing on the influence that these Russian oligarchs have had, quite overtly, on the Conservative Party in terms of donations, in terms of actually entering the House of Lords and things like that. I mean, it's just they're completely tied up with it. And one other aspect of it as well is that Javid described it as a test for the West. But the test for the West actually came, and Brexit is central to this, in the sense that this division in Europe, the Trump administration, lack of clarity and almost sucking up to Putin as well. This has been working away for years and years and years. And the other thing, I'm just ashamed to say, I had no idea that Donetsk and Luhansk since 2014 had been in civil war, and the secessionists within these two areas had set up these autonomous areas. I had no idea whatsoever.
But then this is not reported on because it just feels like that's just not our problem. There's two bits of Georgia whose names I suddenly can't remember. But, you know, they've been in the same sort of just half in between half. And the difficulty for lots of these countries is, as we mentioned before, is that they've all got large Russian populations within them. Finland, and much more strongly Estonia, and even more strongly Latvia and Lithuania. So it destabilizes everyone because these guys, people are not quite sure where their loyalties lie. And you've got to have worked very hard in nation building terms with these countries in just 30 years to create something that makes Russians in those countries feel Estonian, you know, more than Russian. And actually, you know, from having been there just quite recently, Russians still speak Russian in Estonia. You know, they're still speaking their language. They're still, apparently they've got their own schools. You know, they're still sitting as a kind of, and they've got the worst jobs.
Yeah.
You know, so all of that is a recipe for resentment, whether it's a recipe for going as far as saying that they want to turn the tide back is another question. And this is what the imponderable thing is, you know, for a lot of these countries. They have no idea how these populations are going to respond should Putin go further. I mean, I've heard many people say that, however, that for Putin, Ukraine was his particular thing that he felt, you know, strongly that this should never have been allowed. That country should never have been allowed essentially to escape. So, you know, but here we are hoping, you know, this is just playing, you know, with the international agreements on the grounds of what one might hope President Putin feels like.
Yes. And,
I mean, this is an extraordinary situation to be in, but it is. And of course, people will point out that he also has got difficulties with this because from the point of view of his own population, there really isn't a very obvious reason why resources and potentially guys being killed should happen to control a bit of a country which will never be controlled by them easily. Just in the same way as the West might look at it and say that places like Donetsk has been very difficult to maintain as part of Ukraine. Well, they haven't been a doddle for Russia to hold as completely Russian either. And neither would Ukraine. These guys, everyone's been seeing, I'm sure, the kind of stuff on TV of the guys taking up arms and, you know, normal, just youngsters even, coming along to report for sort of duty and everything as a kind of civilian militia. And again, this might seem mind-blowing to people here, but that's precisely what the Finns did in the, you know, in the 1940s. A third of the population, including women, were members of the Finnish army. So, you know, the people who've had that experience, and of course for the Ukrainians, there's been weapons sitting around in the country since 2014. So these guys are not going to go easily. They absolutely will not. And that creates problems for Putin. And, you know, some people suggest that the reason he's been pushed towards this is because there's too many examples right on the borders of the Soviet Union of countries that have gone in a different direction and experiencing a more fair lifestyle. Now, yeah, that's arguable. It's not arguable in the sense of absolutely countries like Estonia and those Baltic republics are much, much more equal and, if you like, familiar. Well, they're members of the EU, you know, so you don't get into that without some kind of profile that matches, if you like, European standards. But, you know, he's got a lot to lose by moving in here and kind of getting committed and bogged down in, yes, Russia's own Vietnam. You know, I mean, it won't be that extreme, obviously, but it's not a no risk venture for him either.
Well, the other risk that has been pointed out is the fact that what if the Russian oligarchs turn around and say, hang on, pal, if any of these sanctions do have an impact upon us, we're not going to be very happy about it, mate. And they wield enormous economic power. But as you said earlier, Leslie, one of the grave difficulties is there's no unity across the European nations in terms of a response to sanctions, particularly to do with the supply of energy, which the Germans are utterly dependent upon their gas supplies from Russia. One of the phrases that's being bandied about just now, which was used in a pejorative term by the Germans in particular, is Finlandization, which is, you know, Finland, neighbour with a very powerful country, you know, refrains from opposing the foreign policy of that very powerful country while maintaining notional national sovereignty. So it's whether that will be the outcome. Does Putin want that as an outcome? Will he accept that concept of Finlandization, where Ukraine does accept the foreign policy objectives of Russia? I nearly said the Soviet Union there. That's how bad it is. And then maintains that degree of separation. Will that be the compromise that's reached, do you reckon?
I don't know, because it doesn't sound to me from the Ukrainians like that's where they want to go. I mean, the Finns have had a long confrontation with the Soviet Union. That policy that they've sort of developed over decades arose from the Winter War of 1939 and then 41. That's a long gestation.
Yeah.
You know, they were obliged in sort of reparations to Russia to provide the Russian army with a lot of in-kind goods because they had no money to pay reparations. And some of that actually is what developed the mobile telephony for the Russian army that finally produced Nokia, the phone company.
Yeah.
So they're an incredibly resilient bunch of people, the Finns, and that's it's a long story where they've arrived at in terms of that sort of neutrality. It's also explained more by looking at their neighbours. I mean, Sweden also not a member of NATO and trying to walk that tightrope as well. Mm-hmm. The Norwegians until recently, with a ban on nuclear submarines coming into Russian ports that was abandoned during the recent conservative government of the Norwegians. So, you know, the backdrop of that clump of countries has all been quite sort of, we're going to just stay out of it. And you might say, given that, you know, you've got countries like Norway that aren't in the EU either, there's quite a lot of, almost abstentionism to some degree in the Nordics from, you know, the rest of the way that Europe conducts itself. That's not true of the next clump, I think, of countries like the Baltic Republics that became independent in 1991. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of time had passed. That's kind of 50 years later. And a lot had, you know, been experienced during that period, which left these countries absolutely certain that they needed to do differently. They needed to join NATO.
Yes.
So that the decision to join the EU, it's like a double lock for them. They joined the EU as a piece of foreign policy support. They joined NATO practically at the same time, and NATO was willing to accept them. Now, in some respects, then, it might be this kind of, this is regarded as the incursion, because yes, this is the movement east of Germany that President Putin is complaining about. And yet, at the same time, it was Russian constant movement around these other places that we had just not heard about that caused these independent republics to decide that they needed more, a different tactic than the Finns, if you like, the Finns kind of neutrality mm-hmm. position. So there's two ways of dealing with this sitting there roughly, but they're explained very largely by the history of those countries and the timing of the development of their thinking. And it looks like Ukraine is sitting awkwardly between all of that. It doesn't look as if NATO wants Ukraine to join. No. I mean, every time Ukraine's president comes out and says really clearly, we want to join, you know, NATO's going, yes, look at that thing on the wall over there. Isn't that interesting the way that's, you know, it's like yeah. nobody's coming back and saying, you're absolutely on, we'll have you in, you know, 6 months, don't you worry. So Ukraine's in a really dreadful position. And that's where I think their own folk are not daft. They realize that it's force that will see Putin, you know, draw back, simply because that's such bad news back home, if there are, you know, the terrible body mm-hmm. bags. And they look like they're the ones that are ready to police that if it comes to it, which is an extraordinary position. We've been here so many times in Europe when essentially the unthinkable, or the stuff we have been lucky enough never to have to think about, begins to kick in, and everybody starts looking the other way, hesitating, not sure how to react. You know, it's been there in Yugoslavia, it's been there in many places, and it's hardly as if Europe covers itself in glory in these moments. And it's a terrible thing to say, but it just does look as if we're heading towards these guys are pretty much going to have to do an awful lot of stuff on their own.
Yep, absolutely. I'm with you on it, because it was the clarity of statement which was that NATO would get immediately involved if there was an incursion. You know, one Russian soldier put a foot inside a NATO country. Ukraine isn't in NATO, and I think you're right. They're on their own in this, and we'll see how it goes in terms of the reality of the fact the swinging financial sanctions, etc., that they've been promised by the West. But Sajid Javid was also questioned as UK Health Secretary about this the new living with COVID plan that's being rolled out in England from Thursday. And I think everybody's probably aware that all the COVID restrictions are end on Thursday. And the biggie, mass testing, ends on April the 1st, an unfortunate choice of dates. And there seemed to have been a split in the cabinet over this, but you know, they're going ahead with it. And the way it's been presented, of course, and I listened to the Today programme, was this whole thing of Scotland in particular. They didn't mention Wales or Northern Ireland, but Scotland being represented as an outlier for taking this more cautious approach in terms of retention of free testing and retention of COVID restrictions.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll hear. I think Nicola's doing a press conference just after, inevitably, after we sort of finish this. But I think we know that it's going to be producing a slightly different line and not an immediate clampdown mm-hmm. and all of this. Dear knows. I mean, I'm sure anybody listening to this would feel more confident with a leader taking a decision who had any track record at all of being governed by the science. That's what the thing is. There will be a point, I'm sure there will be a point where this becomes endemic. We have to learn to live with it. And people are being relied on for themselves to some degree. I would be happy, to be fair, if Nicola Sturgeon decided when that date was, because over the piece personally speaking, I've developed enough trust in her, mostly because she relies so clearly upon her scientific advisors and doesn't end up having rammies with them. You know, it's so that leaves me, because who of us is expert enough to know when this thing has moved from one stage to another or not? So we have to take our cue from leaderships, as it were. And I wouldn't trust Boris Johnson's opinion on, you know, what day, whether it's daytime or nighttime. You know, that's the difficulty for most Scots. And in fact, it extends back into the previous discussion we were having, because as I, you know, as you're listening to Boris Johnson rumbling on about, you know, the situation in Ukraine, there's such massive disbelief waves over you that you start, it actually undermines Britain's even role in these things.
Yes.
Because you begin to imagine he's lying. From the minute you hear him speak, you just imagine that very probably this whole thing is overwrought. There's no real problem for, you know, the Ukraine. He's just using this as a distraction. And you start to dismiss everything he's saying, when in fact, you know, as we've said before, a clock can, you know, be right twice, a broken clock can be right twice a day. It's not even that he's right. His motives could still be appalling. Everything is about distraction, for sure. But, you know, we've now got into such a kind of weary response to Boris Johnson that you don't take his word for anything. You don't imagine that any of his motives are anything other than just trying to kind of divert our attention for no good reason. So I would say on that, I guess we'll just have to wait to see. I was listening to the way the BBC was describing the dilemma of the devolved governments, which is that they have responsibility for public health. And then I would have said, but haven't got the cash to fund it.
Correct.
Right. Whereas how they put it was, but have to resort to British funding to be able to, you know, to police that system, which just sort of implies a sort of cravenness and weakness on the part of the devolved countries, rather than a blooming weakness in the whole system of devolution, that you get powers. You know, it's like giving a bear a toy, but you haven't put the batteries in.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, aye, fine. And then blame the bear because you can't get the thing running around the room properly. So we'll wait to see what happens. I noticed I was off in Glasgow yesterday and they're still handing out packets of test kits at all stations. So, you know, they're still being handed out. You can still test yourselves. It's worth getting a batch and having that. And for people who, the problem will be mostly for people who've got autoimmune problems and stuff like that, is that they won't be, if people aren't testing them, able to test themselves soon, you know, they won't be as confident as they need to be, basically, that they're in the clear.
Yeah. And the BMA have come out against it. They're saying they're failing to protect those most at risk. I mean, and just one of the clear examples is that when Boris Johnson turned around and said people should exercise personal responsibility on isolation. Anyway, Boris Johnson lecturing people on personal responsibility. And it takes us right back, Leslie, to what we talked about 2 years ago in lockdown one, which is the test and protect system, which we said would be utterly dependent on the paucity of statutory sick pay. And Johnson turned around and said, look at Germany, and they've got a great track record on people self-isolating, etc. Well, yeah, because you get 100% of your salary when you're off a sick pay. Our statutory sick pay is absolutely appalling. And then to add to that, I mean, the taking away of the £500 uplift that people on low incomes, you know, that's ending, I think, in 4 weeks' time as well. And then to turn around and say that if you want to take a lateral flow test, if you do not fall into the vulnerable, which is yet to be clearly defined, if you're on low income, it'll just be a couple of pounds. Well, that's a couple of pounds and a couple of pounds and a couple of pounds on top of everything else that's been done to low income families. And it's going to drive people who are infected into work, and into work in places, you know, where there could be spreading events. And it's a distraction, and it's a plain to us what is now, well, the ERG has now become the COVID research group, and it's playing to that right wing of his political party in order to maintain those MPs so he can win or not even be subjected to a vote of confidence. And it's despicable.
I noticed that The Spectator suggests, though, quite strongly that this will not really cut it, because it it wasn't actually the COVID regulations that has precipitated the problems for Boris. It was the Owen Paterson business, where he was prepared to throw pretty much parliamentary democracy to the winds just to kind of bail out a cheat, really. And it was that whole side of things that has caused, you know, the difficulty for him and the lying over the parties. And so their contention is that the business of kind of just getting a bit of flag waving, going and getting David Davis enthusiastic from the back benches when he was, you know, saying in the name of God, go, a couple of weeks ago. He still thinks, presumably, in the name of God, go, from the point of view of, you know, the parties, which are still sitting, waiting in the background there somewhere as to whether or not we ever find out whether he paid a fine, was fined and paid it. And that's still sitting bubbling away. And I mean, I think The Spectator's connections into the right wing of the Tory party are pretty good. But, you know, several of their commentators have said this just does not get Boris off the hook at all. So, you know, we'll see. A funny folk.
Yeah, well, the other thing about the parties, it's the first time I've ever heard that people who have made a statement to Sue Gray and written statements are going to be allowed under very specific circumstances to have a look at the evidence they gave to Sue Gray before they answer questions to the police. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, that's great. Now I know I can just check out and back on the story I spun to Sue Gray before I spin, make sure I'm spinning the same tale to the police. It's that was another one I couldn't get. But you're talking about the BBC's approach to things. Hitting the headlines this week was Sarah Smith, who has now gone to the United States of America, claiming that, stating quite clearly that she was glad to be out of Scotland, even though she was going to the gun-toting USA with all its difficulties, because of the misogynistic violent hatred that she's been subjected to while she was political editor at BBC Scotland.
I sort of hesitated about even writing anything about this, actually, because everybody who's had an opinion has been, you know, it's just, as you just say so often, I'm not very interested in personal stories about people. It also does seem to me that there's just because there's nothing in it. You know, if you start a he said, she said thing about an individual's behaviour, it just distracts from the bigger issues and whatever. So I tried to write a column that was mostly about that bigger issue of the position of a Scotland editor of the BBC. There's a few things, though, that are, you know, OK, everyone said their thing about Sarah Smith. She made mistakes. She kind of apologised, not terribly fulsomely, and the mistakes were all in one direction. Right. Yeah. So we all spotted that. You know, everyone knows that. It puzzled me a little bit. The business about the misogynistic bile was, from her point of view, because the late Father John Smith was a notable critic of Scottish independence, and the presumption was that her views would echo those of her father's. But I sort of wondered about this, because her mother is quite a gal as well, Elizabeth Smith, and actually is also someone who has been very strongly connected with the Labour movement, and also, you know, not so out there as a kind of opponent of Scottish independence, although I don't keep track of it all. And I would have thought, if you were keen on trying to uphold women within the ranks of political opinion, you wouldn't want to airbrush your own mother out of it, you know. But I take the point, her father was a much more prominent political figure. So that's what kind of where she's coming from in all of this. I don't know what, you know, stuff she's got. None of us know each other's online pain. You can guess it, you can look at it. But the thing I was trying to get at is that, of course, Sarah Smith will have less trouble in the States, no matter how, you know, vicious and violent the society gets there, because she's a foreign correspondent there. She's a home correspondent here. You know, she's no skin in the game in America. Yeah. In fact, nobody will even watch her reports. They've got enough of their own, you know, reportage. to sort of go, I don't know, is that that woman that we saw somehow when we were watching BBC World and we saw a report about us and we didn't quite like the way that the Republicans were represented? You know, it's a very, very distant likelihood that she's going to come in the firing line. And she herself has got none of that attachment. You know, she's not American. So it's an entirely different thing to be a foreign correspondent than to be the woman, the Scot, who is reporting on Scotland for the whole of the UK. Now, here's the rub that, you know, she is actually employed by Network. She's employed by London. So she, her job is to explain Scotland essentially to Surrey. I mean, I exaggerate for effect.
Yes.
And yet, so she has to kind of conduct all her stuff for them, who are barely interested in the entire situation in Scotland. And yet those same reports are being watched, digested and critiqued by us who are hugely interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always going to be a tough one for a BBC Scotland editor. And to make this kind of point, they're essentially stretched across the wheel of Scotland's constitutional divide. If they don't look like they're taking the independence cause seriously, 50% of Scots trash them in a minute, in an instant. If they do look like they're taking the independence side of this, and this is we're evenly balanced now. There's two narratives for everything. You know, and this is the reality of where we are. If they do look as if they're taking that seriously, they sound like nationalists to London HQ. So, you know, it's a really, I'm not making excuses for her at all. I think James Cook will make probably a better fist of that job, but it's still a tough one. If anybody thinks that there's a little, if anybody in that position thinks there's a safe haven somewhere where you can be the old BBC that just hands down a single tablet of stone judgment on the perspective on something. Those days have gone for almost any story anywhere, but in Scotland, absolutely they've gone. And the other thing is, you know, you become the sort of accessible face of the corporation so that every other hurt that's given to the dignity of a cause that has got 50% support in this country by the BBC, it gets visited back on you, you know. So that too is just something you have to wear. And unfortunately, the BBC doesn't give its own staff much of a break that way, because although the Question Time programme is not run by the BBC Scotland editor, the fact that if you're watching that in Scotland and you may see a bust-in audience that suddenly becomes peculiarly pro-Brexit and pro-Tory in a way that you know is not characteristic of, let's say, Dundonians, for example, you only need to see that to just have instant mistrust of the entire branding, the entire corporation, even though that's produced by an independent company. It's got the BBC moniker on it. The BBC are the executive editors of that programme. And the next time you see a BBC spokesperson who's anywhere close to making that similar sort of mistake, they're gone for you. And and once somebody hasn't got status or respect or anything going for them, they become very easy targets on social media because you feel they're just apparatchiks. You don't feel that they're actually autonomous thinking people that live in this blinking country where they must walk around and realise that independent supporters are not mad ants locked away in the attic. Yeah. We are half the population. So it's a tough one, and it will be tough, you know, for everybody that walks that line. And I would say good luck to James Cook, and let everybody just let him do his job.
Yeah, I mean, James Cook, though, falls in an honourable tradition of political editors being Dundee United supporters. So I'm just delighting it there. The other thing I wondered about, Leslie, is that we've had the Baroness Davidson now comes out and she gets a piece in the Times about being shouted at in the street, which is wholly inappropriate, but that suddenly becomes the headline. We get there's a narrative starting to build up now across the way in terms of unionism, which is nasty gnats. What about your pensions? What about borders? Skegxit is now being used, that equals Brexit. I just wonder if there's something building up here that, you know, again, are they getting ready for the referendum in 2023 that some people, many people who support independence don't believe is coming? Do the unionists believe it's coming? And is this part of the narrative they're constructing?
It does. I mean, you would have to say, you know, it just doesn't look coincidental. And, you know, we know that the way things worked the last time and have continued to work is that there's been a lot of organisation and quiet meetings in boardrooms and that level of thing. I mean, these are, the yes side is very public, social media oriented and street kind of action oriented. The no side has always been trying to nobble the decision makers. And they do that in private meetings that have been constantly held, as far as I can understand, over the last intervening years, COVID notwithstanding. So I imagine that is simply ramping up. And yes, it does look not entirely coincidental that the Express particularly has almost sometimes managed to sideline its total preoccupation with weather, which we might come on to at some point, at an extraordinary time when weather actually really does deserve everybody's attention, to try to kind of put forward these endless problems that are coming ahead in their eyes for the independence case. I mean, probably because they can see that, you know, the independent supporters would also like some high level decisions made about policy on these things. And yet, you know, there's been some very good kind of pushbacks done, particularly on pensions. I mean, the Nationals done some very good work getting former Tory pensions ministers to explain the entitlement that one has to a pension wherever you are in the world once you've paid into the British system. So, you know, there's kind of pushbacks coming from the other side, but you would have to say it does look like they realise that people are making their minds up whether there is or isn't going to be an active campaign soon. And God, let's just, you know, who knows? People are still making their minds up. You know, they're thinking through an awful lot of stuff. And I think the unionist side realised that in this period of default, of not active campaigning, they've got so much going the wrong way with Westminster that they probably need to weigh in and try to just create some disinformation and worry on the other side, in the knowledge that it won't get immediately smacked down because the SNP Scottish Government are not yet in campaign mode. So it's kind of pretty good that I think the other side are, you know, the papers like the National have engaged, and we probably all need to be doing that. I mean, I was up in Yes Lough Aber, who were tremendous, actually. They got about 80 people out on the same night as the opening night of the Mountain Film Festival.
In
the other hall, actually. And I must say, when I looked at the kind of programme, I thought, jings, I'm a bit torn, you know, So that was a great turnout from folk that had come from the islands and all sorts, you know, to get there. I think mostly because people just want to recharge and connect and so on. But they're very purposeful. They've set themselves up, you know, properly. They've got all the constitution sort of rewritten. They've got the bank accounts sorted out. They've got a really active little posse there in their committee. They've sought out younger people with social media skills, because they're in it now. You know, their intention is to really get going, whatever's happening. And I can't tell you how enlivening it is to be in the company of people who feel like that, because it is absolutely infectious. You know, it pulls everybody else in. So that was a tremendous event, and really congratulations to them, because I think they're the first actual meeting I've been at for 2 years. Yeah. You know, there's been plenty of people who've talked about having one. And this is no criticism either, because they've discovered their own folk didn't want to turn out.
Yeah.
But there's something at the moment that people feel that, you know, I mean, people were sitting with their masks on and all the rest of it. And, you know, there was much washing of hands and, you know, the sanitizers and all the rest of it. But people were still there, and they look ready to go. So yeah. I just wonder how everybody else feels.
Yeah, well, the other thing about it was that I don't know how they were reacting to the weather up there, but I don't know if you saw the BBC weatherman who was describing the impact of the one before Franklin, was it the Erwin?
Eunice. It was Dudley, or I think Dudley, because I nipped up avoiding Dudley, if it was Dudley, and then came back in Eunice, you know, right. So sort of, I knew my storms by then.
Well, well done, because I was, but anyway, when he was talking about Storm Eunice, and he was showing it the impact in the southeast of England, and the statement there was, and of course, this is going to have a tremendous impact, this level of storm, and of course, it would have, you get these winds up in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, but have less impact, you know, because fewer people and not so much infrastructure, and I'm going, what? Number one, why would you actually say that? You know, you don't need to do that to get across the impact that would be had without turning around and saying, well, if you go up to that bit of Scotland, not going to have much impact at all. You know, there's nobody there and they've not got much going on for them up there anyway. I thought it was completely crass and just exemplified the sort of metropolitan bias and mindset that people are totally unaware of. It's their common sense. But yeah,
well, I cannot tell you how I had to just switch the radio off at times. I mean, I quite get a lot of people who just say, just don't travel when it's that dodgy. And I had actually said to the guys in Fort William, you know, this will be a bit interesting because there's almost no time I can go short of coming 3 days early to guarantee missing all these storms and everything. But, you know, they'd advertised it and whatever. And the thing is, as well, they weren't so badly affected. I mean, the Highlands were sitting out of much of that for once. And it's an interesting thing about human nature that everybody tends to, I think, I'm not saying anybody felt this or said this at all, but I think the West Coasters, I mean, islanders in the West Coast tend to think that if anybody from the East Coast is complaining about wind, they've had indigestion, you know, because the real winds, I mean, just, you know, shocking stuff that's happened. Do you remember the family that drowned, you know, in the Western Islands at Yuchta, trying to get away from the flood levels that are rising. And those islands are sitting in danger of actual inundation, you know, now.
Yeah.
So people kind of discount stuff a bit. And yet Storm Arwen on the East Coast was absolutely devastating.
Yes.
And I think if you weren't in our bit of the East Coast and you don't walk around very much in life, you still don't get just quite how, you know, the landscape has been transformed by the removal of the level of trees there are. And that was massive. So I think people sort of, and that was a red alert. This is what really annoyed me. When I was tweeting that, I thought you just have to not ram this down people's throats. Because the first time I heard, I think it was the World at One talk about the imminent and rare red alert, I just put back, there was a red alert on November the 29th, I think, for Storm Arwen here. You know, like, that's not rare then, is it, for the Britain?
No.
You know, just to have one 2 months, 3 months ago is not rare. Of course, people will say, you know, but there was 90 mile an hour stuff measured on the Tay Road Bridge that day.
Yep.
So, you know, what are you saying? It's just that it's rare for London. I'll grant you that, you know, I can remember being down in London. I think it was 1987 when Seven Oaks became Two Oaks. <You know? laughs> And that was extraordinary because since nobody was used to sort of storm rattling stuff, there was broken windows and stuff everywhere because everything was just fragile. You know, it wasn't used to having that kind of level of rattle. But still, it just gives the lie to the notion that we're this is a British-wide service because it's just not accurate. It's not rare. And then, you know, there's interesting stuff that does flow from that. John Swinney was on and he just said something that, you know, didn't get picked up on, where he was saying, if we're now moving to a situation where very high winds are a kind of feature of our lives, because this has been more high winds than, you know, than normal, you have to rethink overhead power cables completely.
Yes.
You have to rethink ferries, and let's face it, you know, they need a bit of rethinking anyway. But as you know, so many people like Angus Brendan McNeill, you know, who spent a lot of time in the Faroes, anyone who spends time in the Nordics will see that many of them opted a long time ago for tunnels, partly because of wind issues, because it may feel scary to people to be going in tunnels. But if you're an islander, you might prefer the option of going to a tunnel or sitting in an island, not in your home, for up to a week, which is what happens at the moment. You look online and you'll see scandals about ferries not being able to bring. It's 8 days now since some islands have had food brought in. So, you know, we've got to rethink a lot of our infrastructure if we're going to be dealing with this level of winds all the time. This is a real serious one for the whole of Britain, but for Scotland for sure. And yet it's just still being treated as it's weather, it'll be gone tomorrow. And the other thing that had me, I'll have to say, incandescent with rage was as I was kind of skiting around a wee bit, coming from the Spean Bridge Road that people may know, the Roy Bridge Road across country to join the A9 at Dalwhinnie. The gritter, I think, had sort of gone on that Spean Bridge Road to Newton Moor, and the dog leg that you take to come down to the A9 was pretty bad. You know, it was a fair old whiteout with no grit that I could see. And having been a bit of a veteran of driving in snow when I used to have the Bothy, the hut up in Glenbucket, and used to go up, you know, right over the Devil's Elbow in snow in an old Peugeot 205, you do learn a little bit about driving in snow, but lots of people aren't used to it. And they had folk coming on from Transport Scotland, you know, and I was listening for very precise information about where there was either roadblocks or very bad snow. Yeah. And instead of getting that detail, there was just this useless kind of summary of, you know, there can be difficulties in places and people should drive to the weather conditions. And you think, could you just get somebody on like Alan Douglas, actually, from who lives up a glen, an Angus Glen, and knows all about blimmin' driving in snow, to tell people how to do that? Because I was passing people who had stalled, just had given up practically, were just terrified of the fact that they were about to go downhill and weren't sure how to tackle that. You know, people are now not used to the sudden arrival of snow. And I know people can do, we should all have snow tires. Yeah. But, you know, we're not sitting with it yet as a regular enough thing. And if you're a public service broadcaster, what you need to be telling people is what they need to know right then, which is low speeds, high gear. Now, I know somebody will come in and say the opposite, but for most petrol or, you know, whatever cars, electric, I understand, has got different, you know, working, mm-hmm. so have automatics. But for the bulk of people who are out there, you just need to try to get into a higher gear when you're on snow, because it increases the traction with the snow and just keep your speed down. And that simple bit of information, that's what should, you know, that's what we need. But I have a suspicion that the folk who are sitting, you know, doing the broadcasting just don't connect enough with the rural road that people are slithering mm-hmm. around to feel that that was needed, you know. So, yeah, there was a lot of effing and blinding, I have to say, when I was listening to all this.
Yeah, well, there's been no effing and blinding from the Climate Change Assembly, who replied to the Scottish Government response to their report. And you and I are big fans of citizens' assemblies. I mean, they were very, very diplomatic in their introduction in the response to the Scottish Government's response to what they said. But when you actually dig into it, Leslie, they are not very happy people. And it's been put in the most douce of terms. But things that stood out to me, and I will be putting up a link to the report, the Scottish Government, and this will sound very familiar to you, should think less about what it can't do and demonstrate a positive attitude thinking about what it can do. They're disappointed with many responses, and they're failing to recognise the urgency of actions needed. And here we go. Far too many considers and explores in the response. And there seemed to be a trotting out, because when I initially read the Scottish Government's response, there seemed to be a constant reference to measures that the Scottish Government had already taken to the suggestions made by the Climate Change Assembly. Oh, well, we should think about reuse. And the Scottish Government said, well, we do have this recycling policy. Stuff like that was constantly being brought up. Well, we're already doing this. They say that they're not using the land use policies devolved, and that should be used in terms of actually restructuring taxation on power companies, for example. So they're not terribly happy with it at all. And what they want to see coming out with it is them wanting to be bold, take innovative approaches, and appoint independent scientific advisors to come up with a Scottish scorecard with 10 key performance indicators that need to be reported upon annually. And they've punted it back to the Scottish government to turn around and say, look, come on, guys, you know, even though we've been very diplomatic about this, you're actually just throwing out these explorers, these considers, we're already doing all this. And it's clear and explicit when you read the report that they believe the Scottish government is not being bold enough. And they're actually saying, well, we're doing this already, and they're not taking urgent enough action. So it's a very, very disappointing response from the Scottish government. And I think should tack tent to what the Climate Change Assembly response has been to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, good for them. I mean, you'd like to think that they will get something, a more tangible outcome. But I mean, you know, the problem is there's no bigger predator in the food chain than the Scottish government. You know, they're
yes.
They're like deer on half the Highland Estates. There's nothing kind of keeping them guarded in any way at all. So I don't see why the Scottish government will give a more fulsome response to them than they have to practically everybody, their own committees, to think tanks, to, you know, people just pulling their hair out now with the level of not getting on with stuff that we could get on with.
Yeah.
If anybody wants to listen to some very in detail stuff, for example, about the way that Sweden and Denmark have state-of-the-art district heating, that doesn't mean that every individual person has to have boilers and maintain the cost of change. There's a podcast that you can get from the Nordic Horizons website based on the last event we had, which is at nordichorizons.org. And if you're interested as well in the whole where we go next with the Russian challenge, shall we just put it diplomatically?
Yeah.
The next Nordic Horizons event is also just about that and has someone from Finland, Norway and Denmark talking. So equally, nordichorizons.org, you can get the invite for that. Apologies for the plug, but if I didn't do it, who will?
Nobody will. And just to put it out there for our subscribers, we are planning an event for those of you who are pals. That is going to be another live Q&A that will be coming up shortly, and you will be getting informed about this. And just to say thanks to everyone who subscribed, pals and buddies. It's through your subscriptions that we're able to do things like engage in all the extras that we've done, the most recent one with Dr. Philippa Whitford. And I think we both agreed that this one is so significant, it will be going out pretty shortly to everyone, because it was incredibly interesting. But if you want to hear it now, folks, it's up there for the subscribers, and I recommend everybody to have a good listen, because it's in very, very interesting on so many levels, all the things that we've been talking about. Well, I'm in a cheery mood, Leslie, because you're probably aware, and I did refer to the world famous Dundee United earlier, that we secured a famous, or infamous if you're a Rangers supporter, draw on Sunday. And
I'm sorry, I mean, I know what the history of that is, but really, when you world famous draws, I mean, come
oh,
on.
Oh yeah, world famous Dundee United. I mean, oh no, that is genuinely a joke. We refer to ourselves as that. But it was interesting.
It's the level of getting excited about a draw that's the conceptual problem. I mean, that's some deal with Rangers form, and it's, you know, your relative positions and everything. That's all I meant.
Yes, I know. But the big thing about it was the way to say there is the serious point behind this, because if my team win, lose or draw, if we lose, it's not an earth shattering event, and my whole world order, it does not come tumbling down because Dundee United lose, you know, when we should have had a penalty, for example, at Celtic Park when we played the other side of the Glasgow. Anyway, but yes, so it's looking a cracking day out there now, despite the fact it was lousy early this morning. So I'm going to be taking advantage just after the podcast to get out and about, and I hope you do as well, Leslie.
Absolutely, yep. There's a little group of us meeting online to try to think of ways to make some incredibly immediate change to the housing situation for young people in the Highlands. There's not anything I can say about this yet, except that it will not be waiting for all the authorities to agree.
Right.
So that's my early afternoon, and then I'll be out like a whippet.
And on that startling greyhound-like news, we'll see you next week, Johnson.